This is the Generations Radio Broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host, with you today. And we bring a biblical worldview to bear in history as well as in current events. And friends, without applying the structure of a biblical worldview, that is a presuppositional framework of biblical understanding of what is right and wrong, what is just and unjust, if we can't apply a biblical view, then how in the world can we interpret what is right and what is wrong, what is preferred and what is less preferred in terms of public policy? How can we identify who are the good kings, the bad kings? How can we identify what is a good agenda, what is a bad agenda for our present situation? We must apply God's law, God's definitions of right and wrong, if we're to understand history and current events as well. And so today we have a question that comes in from our listening audience. And friends, if you have a question, if you have an issue you'd like us to discuss on this program, just simply email me directly at host@generations.org. This from Steve. I have a close friend whose son is doing his high school senior thesis on whether or not it would have been right for a Christian to support the American Revolution. I'm giving him what little I have. Wondered if you could do a program on the topic, or if you have any suggested resources I could pass along. Just do this off the top of your head. Don't take a ton of time. Steve. All right. Well, we won't take a ton of time, but we will take some time on this program to address the question. I think it's an important question. We deal with it in some detail in America and God's Providence. So our 1,000-page Christian worldview perspective of American history is probably the best part to place to start. I think as Christians, we need to give our kids the 500 years of the American Christian heritage, the rise and fall of the Republic, the rise and fall of our civilization, the rise and fall of the Christian influence upon a civilization. God's blessing certainly did visit this country over a period of several hundred years, but sadly we have abandoned the heritage and we have become pretty much the greatest debtor nation on earth, and we are headed down fast, fast, fast. All right, so that's where we are right now, but let's analyze our history just for a moment. And Steve Vaughn is with me today on the program. Steve, we appreciate the fact that we do have a Christian heritage. We have the Bill of Rights. We have the influence of godly Christians all the way back to the Puritans and Pilgrims, and then on into Samuel Adams, Patrick Henry, George Washington, all of which were professing Christians. Probably the most godly Christian leaders the world has ever known, collected in the American colonies in the first roughly 150 years or 180 years of this nation's history, until the 1790s, when the French Revolution, the Enlightenment, pretty much kicked in, and deism and Unitarianism destroyed the United States, especially the northern states. Well, thankfully, we did have a heritage. Thankfully, we did have something of a Christian foundation for this nation, and I'm thankful.
Yeah, me too. I mean, you take a look at that. You take a look at the 3 million people that were in America at that time that produced people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin and all these very wise people that established this country. And now we have 330 some million people, and our country has produced Bernie Sanders, AOC, Lady Gaga. Mm-hmm. You know, who do we have? You know, I think God was really shining his providence on the early Americans at that time.
Yeah. Well, friends, before we take the break, here's the overarching principle. The question is, should American Christians, American pastors have condemned the war for independence? Now, immediately when you call it a revolutionary war, you're assuming that it was a revolution. It was not a war for independence. And so The term you use betrays something of your bias, so you have to be cautious with the terms you use. But Romans 13, verse 7 gives us the overarching principle for Christians, and that is to pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, honor to whom honor is owed. Now, the $100,000 question is, well, who is owed the honor? Who is it that's owed the honor? That's the question. Steve, you get a letter from the Exchequer of England. I guess that's what they call the tax collector. You get a letter from the Exchequer of England, and he's asking for $800 of taxes or £800 of taxes. What are you going to do? You going to fork it over?
No, I would first of all write him a letter back, if I even respond, and I'd say, well, if you think it's owed owed to you. Come and talk to me, but make sure you knock first.
Yeah, have a discussion about that, because you don't believe you owe anything to the government of England. And see, here's the challenge: is when you come to federal republics, when you come to constitutional republics, it's not always clear to whom you're owed the honor, especially when there's balance of powers that already exist within the systems. So sometimes it's not clear, particularly when one particular part of the government is usurping the authority of the other part. So now what do you do? Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee, they had to answer the question, do I honor the United States of America or do I honor the Republic of Virginia? Do I owe my fealty to the Republic of Virginia or the Republic of the United States? It's not always cut and dried. And yet there are two ditches that we have to avoid. One is anarchy and the other is tyranny. By the way, both are active in Washington these days. Right? I mean, it's funny how, you know, it's not so funny. It's odd and it's rather discouraging that the more you see in terms of tyranny, the more you see in terms of anarchy in America is seeing anarchy ratcheting up as well as tyranny. They play off on each other. In fact, I would argue that anarchy and tyranny are best friends. Anarchy being the idea of being a law to yourself and abandoning God's laws, but being a law to yourself. Tyranny being the government or the corporate body of the nation exerting itself against the laws of God and shaking its fist against God and His law. Let us break their bands asunder. Let us cast their cords from us. All right, so tyranny is when the corporate body shakes its fist in God's face. Anarchy is when the individual shakes his fist in God's face. And both are equally horrendous. On the one hand, it's dishonoring God's appointed authorities. On the other hand, supporting a government that abandons God's laws. So you can be in either of the ditches, and we as Christians must avoid both. Be back with more in just a moment on the Generations Broadcast.
Ever since the creation of the Garden of Eden, Satan has been working his hardest to erase the knowledge of God and seduce the creatures made in God's image to think that they are the center of the universe. One look at today's society and you see his progress. Humanistic thought has inundated our culture, and we can trace its roots directly back to the classroom and the textbooks we're setting in front of our kids. That's why every Christian homeschool parent should have a curriculum that's not only rock solid academically, but most importantly will point students back to their Creator as the source of all wisdom and knowledge, and to Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior. If you've been struggling to find such a curriculum, look no further. Here at Generations, we've spent over 15 years developing our Christian discipleship curriculum to help Christian homeschool parents like you pass on the faith to your children by teaching a God-centered view of life and integrating the Bible into every lesson. Our goal is to not only help you meet your students' academic needs, but also to assist you in discipling your children for generations to come. So get started today with our Christian discipleship curriculum and watch your children marvel, learn, and mature as they embark on a God-focused learning adventure to discover more about the world around them and the one who made it all. You can learn more about our curriculum resources and pick up our newly released fifth grade curriculum pack today at generations.org/curriculum. That's generations.org/curriculum.
And we're back on the Generations Broadcast addressing Steve's question as to whether or not Christians should have supported the American Revolution. That's the question. Now, of course, the principle is honor to whom honor is due. But here's the question for us as we participate in constitutional republics. Is the highest law of the land going to be the king? Or is the highest law of the land going to be the U.S. Supreme Court? Or is the highest law of the land the Constitution and God's law? And this was the question that Sam Rutherford addressed in his book Lex Rex. He insisted that the law is king. Whereas King James I came back and said, I'm it. I'm the highest law of the land. And whatever I say happens. And so tyrants have always wanted that. Tyrants have always wanted themselves to be the highest law, the highest standard of the land. So King James I said, rex lex, the king is law. But Samuel Rutherford said, lex rex, the law is king. And you can imagine how King James I felt about that. He wasn't very happy with Samuel Rutherford. And Samuel Rutherford was almost killed. He was he died on the way to prison. But he was not appreciated, and his book Lex Rex was burned in bonfires throughout England. So just FYI, they weren't very keen on Samuel Rutherford, one of the godliest men in all of Western history. But anyway, the point being that we have to figure out who the highest authority is. Is it the king or is it the Constitution? Now, England had to deal with that with Charles I. He was attempting to put England under French control and invite French armies into England. The Parliament didn't like it. So who owes honor to who in a situation like that? Now, in the case of the American colonists, if the king was violating the Magna Carta, the colonists considered him the rebel. You see, because the king was subject to the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta had been signed by the monarchy and by the lords in 1215, approximately 600 years earlier. And the kings had been subject to the Magna Carta for 600 years. And now somehow the king was trying to throw off that authority, and the colonists saw him as the rebel. He was the revolutionary. We weren't the revolutionaries. The king was the revolutionary. And so the lower magistrates had the obligation to remove him from office or remove the nation out from under his authority. So what do Christians do when there's just chaos? The king or the president has abandoned the Constitution, his oath of office. You don't go to anarchy. What you do is you look for the law-abiding lower magistrates to help you. And that's been the approach that Christians have taken all the way back into the Old Testament era. And, of course, there were many books written on this issue. The Huguenots wrote a number of books. Samuel Rutherford wrote his book. So this issue of the lower magistrate stepping in when the king had abandoned his position as the legal head of the nation, what do you do in anarchical situations such as that? Well, the lower magistrates, who were law-abiding citizens, would step in and set up a government. So that's the kind of thing that happened over hundreds and hundreds of years, really all the way back to the Magna Carta. So that's what Christians have done for 800 years. That's how we have returned to a state of decent law and order over 800 years. Christian governments in the West are constitutional, contractual. Now, I realize that's not the way things are done in banana dictatorships, where there's no respected constitution, where people rule by fiat, not by law. But in the Western world, in the Christian world, Christian governments and Christian presidents are allowed to function under a constitution, under a contractual basis. They take an oath of office where they must subscribe to the Constitution of the United States. If governing officials will violate the contract, then what happens? What happens if somebody violates the contract? Steve, you're a businessman, right? Somebody violates the contract, what happens?
Well, depending on how bad it is, it could be a breach of contract, and the contract becomes null and void.
Yeah, the deal's over. Yeah, they're gone. See ya. Bye. The president's not a president anymore. He's violated the contract. So I know this is a shock to the system of those of you that have been raised in banana dictatorships in South America or in Africa, and some of you have been trained in public schools. You know, you're not aware of, you know, the history of Christian government, but if you live in the Western world and you have something of a rooting and grounding in history and the history of the battles for Christian liberty in the Western world, you've read my book, The Story of Freedom. You've read America in God's Providence. Then hopefully your children and your families and your posterity will be rooted in these ideas, and you won't be consigned to gulags and banana dictatorships. That would be our goal for the program. but the American colonies were self-governing as well. They'd been self-governing since 1612. And now the Parliament was increasingly stepping in and imposing their systems on the colonies. The first House of Burgesses actually was established in Virginia, not in 1612, but 1619. So that's when the first Parliament, they call them the mini parliaments, The first parliament in America was formed in 1619. Connecticut's general court was formed in 1636. Massachusetts set up two houses of the government in 1634. So the Magna Carta and the English Bill of Rights of 1689 had allowed for these liberties. And so the colonists had taken full advantage of these liberties. The king and the parliament could not toss out these rights willy-nilly. They didn't have the power to do so because they were subservient to the Magna Carta and the English Bill of Rights. And there was no taxation without representation, according to the English Bill of Rights and the Magna Carta. These had been encoded in British law. And the colonists consider themselves English citizens. Now, see, again, this is very, very important. They consider themselves English citizens, that they were citizens of England. And they had formed these colonies, and they had their own parliaments, their own governments. And then suddenly the King of England said, erase all that. We're not going to play by the Bill of Rights anymore. We're not going to play by the Magna Carta from this point forward. In October of 8th of 1774, the Declaration of Rights and Resolves came from the Continental Congress. Okay, and these guys said, okay, now we're Englishmen. We are citizens of England, and therefore we have the rights of Englishmen. And the king has violated our rights, and so we have the right of assembly and petition, the right to be free of a standing army, and we have the right to vote for our own leaders in our own assemblies and so forth. And so, you know, we've been under these rights for approximately 160 years, and you're going to take them away from us? I don't think so. You're violating contract. You're rebels. You're revolutionaries. You revolted against the rule of law. And we actually are submitting ourselves to the rule of law, and you're not. And so we are not going to break the law. We're not going to give way to anarchy, as you are. And so we are going to take a stand against you, England, for your violation of the rule of law. And that, my friends, is what constituted the absolute rightfulness of the colonists to stand against the tyranny and the anarchy of the King of England in the 1770s. Before he died, George Whitefield, the great evangelist, who, by the way, was an Englishman, was a Brit, George Whitefield condemned his government for falsely representing the people of New England. He assumed that England would stay true to the original charter. He called it the Christian Charters. He said, these guys have signed up to the Christian Charters, and you guys need to maintain it in the Parliament. But, of course, they didn't. Well, pastors encouraged their congregations to obey God rather than men when it came to this revolutionary activity on the part of Parliament and the King of England. Moses Mather, who was the great-great-grandson of Richard Mather, the grandson of Increase Mather, he would preach, turn your eyes to the free states of Holland and Switzerland, and in them you will see America struggling under intolerable impressions and with an intrepid, unquenchable spirit overlooking all danger, bursting the bonds and demolishing the engines of tyranny. Okay, that's the way that these pastors preached as they approached these tyrannical anarchists who were violating the rule of law across the ocean. Moses Mather's grandfather, Increase Mather, fought tooth and nail for the restoration of a charter for New England in the 1690s. He got it from William and Mary, thankfully. I have the whole story, by the way, in my book, American Faith, 27 Sketches from Winthrop to Wilkerson. That's a great story. I think Increase Mather is one of my very favorites, probably top three of my favorite stories of godly, intrepid, courageous, faith-filled Christians who were able to fight for liberty. And Increase Mather, one of the most important pastors, maintained something of a conservative nature for Harvard University until it went liberal in the 1720s. Thankfully, Increase Mather fought for our liberty as well, as he was over there in England working very, very hard to restore the charter for New England in the 1690s. In fact, they tried to arrest him on his way out, but he and his, I think, 14-year-old son were able to slip onto a rowboat in the middle of the night, and they were able to just barely make it to a ship and sail away before he was arrested by the British gendarmes that did not want him to gain a new charter for New England. Again, it was a constant effort to fight for the charters, for the colonies, against the tyrannies of the day. Believe me, tyrants are always doing their best to try to ruin liberty and to break contract. And that was what England attempted to do many, many times until you got to the 1770s, 1780s. And at that point, the war for independence was inevitable.
Yeah, and they didn't just jump straight to war. I mean, they wrote letters, they met with the king, they gave him their grievances. I think they followed almost a Matthew 18 kind of thing. Here's what you've done. And he's saying, no, that we still are ruling over you. And he increased the taxes. He did more things to that were wrong, that were tyrannical. And so they gave plenty of chances. And it's just like with Patrick Henry's speech, we've already done all of these things. Now it's time for liberty or death.
Yeah, and some folks, want a biblical basis for the lower magistrates opposing the tyrannical systems of kings and parliaments and such. And entire books were written on this by Samuel Rutherford and others. One of the examples is 1 Samuel chapter 14, where Saul had made a decree. They're going up against the Philistines, I believe. And in 1 Samuel 14, Saul, the king, made a decree that, "Cursed be the man who eats food until the evening, and I am avenged of my enemies." Well, his son Jonathan eats some honey. Do you remember the story? And then the people said to Saul, "Shall Jonathan die, who has worked this great salvation in Israel?" It turns out Jonathan was, the guy who actually won the battle. So is he going to die? As the Lord lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people ransomed Jonathan so that he did not die. The people interposed between Saul and Jonathan to protect Jonathan's life from an unjust decree. So this would be an example of how the lower magistrates have a responsibility to interpose. And this would be one example. There are many other examples that people appeal to in Scripture. But you do remember the Magna Carta. In the field of Runnymede in England, the Christian nobles took King John's tyranny to task. Remember, King John was raping the daughters and the wives of the lords. He was a bad dude. You can read the story about it in my book, The Story of Freedom. But people need to understand, this guy was really bad. But by God's grace, they were able to get King John to sign the Magna Carta, and that became the basis for Christian liberties for the next 800 years. So, friends, that's the story. That's the story as best as I can give it to you. I think we should know our history. We absolutely should know our history. You need to teach your kids this stuff, my friends. You need to give them American faith and America and God's providence and the story of freedom. These are the books that we provide for our Christian discipleship curriculum for junior high and high school levels. But most of them are written so they can be read aloud as a family, and they're a lot of fun to read, especially the biographies like American Faith. Encourage you to read those out loud. But if we don't know our history, man, we're going to be in trouble. Tyrants are always going to try to create a nation of dictators who are not subject to a constitution. And the Supreme Court of the United States, the courts in America, have been reinterpreting the Constitution by our Darwinistic democratic ethic. I mean, that's been happening for a long time, friends. They're reconstructing the whole original intent of the Constitution. They're just abandoning the written law and providing what was some refer to as a Darwinistic democratic ethic. And that comes all the way back from Christopher Columbus Langdell, who was, I believe, a president of Harvard Law School in the 1880s. Oliver Wendell Holmes, Benjamin Cardozo, all those guys in the 1920s, the 1930s, 1940s, were working very, very hard to create the Darwinistic democratic ethic that led to Roe v. Wade and the decisions that have abandoned the Constitution entirely. These guys don't want to be subject to a rule of law. They don't want to rule by the Constitution. They want to throw that out the door, and they want to rule by whim. They want absolute power to determine law and to evolve into more tyrannical laws and a control of the nation by way of 9 Supreme Court justices or one dictator, one president. That's where we're headed, my friends. We're headed towards an all-out tyranny. Why? Because we're abandoning 800 years of a Western approach to government that comes by contract, by constitution, by a submission to the laws of God. Now, there is a huge difference between the Americans claiming their rights by written documents that have been around for 600 years and the French Revolution. So I think people need to understand the American Revolution was not a revolution. It was a war for independence against a revolutionary state, the Parliament, the King of England. They were the revolutionaries. And we were just trying to retain a rule by law. Now, the French Revolution had thrown off the rule of law and it created an all-out revolution in the 1790s. The French Revolution wasn't based on written documents like the Magna Carta that had been written down and securing the rights of British citizens for 600 years. That wasn't the French Revolution. French Revolution was inventing an amorphous, socialist, Marxist agenda of equality and fraternity, quote unquote, and nobody was safe under the arbitrary dictatorship of Robespierre, as everybody knows. These guys were not operating under encoded law. The French Revolution was a revolt. It was anarchy. It was demonic to the core. Immorality characterized the philosophers from the beginning to the end. Voltaire took his niece as his mistress. Rousseau abandoned his five children on the steps of an orphanage, never married his girlfriend. Voltaire was embittered against Christianity. And Voltaire also introduced evolutionary racism. He was the first to call Africans apes, non-humans. That's Voltaire, okay? This is the sick revolutionary philosophy of the French in the 1770s and 1780s. Voltaire rejected the possibility of an afterlife, embraced a worldview of scientific materialism. Rousseau favored an autonomous romanticism or irrationalism. He was extremely proud, and he wanted man to be proud and to rule by autonomous human reason. Now, friends, the French Revolution began with a murder of the king and his wife in 1793. But it wasn't until 1794 when, man, things just got crazy. They wanted to shake off the heritage, the moral conscience, the symbols, the spiritual influence of 1,600 years of Christian faith in Europe. That was the goal of the French Revolution. In some places, Christian worship was banned upon pain of death in the French Revolution. Christian symbols were torn down everywhere, crosses destroyed, just like what they're doing in communist China right now. The Clermont Cathedral was confiscated, given the name the Temple of Reason. Men and women exchanged their Christian names for ancient pagan Roman names. The Cathedral of Notre Dame was turned into another Temple of Reason, and an actress was set on the high altar and given the title Goddess of Reason. It was as if the dragon himself was released from the bottomless pit, and the reign of terror began in September of 1793 with a call to action for Bertrand Barrere. He said, hey, let us make terror the order of the day. And Robespierre said, yeah, terror is nothing more than speedy, severe, and inflexible justice, thus an emanation of virtue. And then 17,000 people were executed by the guillotine. The spiritual element was working overtime behind the scenes to produce the mayhem, endless bloodshed, unrelenting terror. Hundreds of secret cults surfaced and proliferated, pornography and prostitution, rampant satanic orgies, black masses, sexual perversion, blasphemies were the order of the day all around Paris. Nobody was safe. And of course, Robespierre was taken to execution on July 24, 1794 himself. During the revolution, it was Louis Michel, Le Pelletier de Saint, who was advocating a socialist education program patterned after Sparta, much encouraged in the writings of both Voltaire and Rousseau. That's how we get modern socialist education came out of the French Revolution. On September 25th, 1791, this guy presented a new penal code in which he had eliminated what he called the phony offenses created by superstition or Christianity, including such things as witchcraft, sodomy, and incest. So all that became legal. That was the end product, the satanic incursion into the Christian West that occurred in the 1790s. So again, my friends, know your history. And here, one more thing. Remember, as America approached the war for independence in the 1770s, it was the preaching of George Whitefield that mattered. It wasn't, they weren't buying into Voltaire. They weren't buying into Robespierre and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the sick, horrible, humanistic, atheistic doctrine of these radical Enlightenment writers like Voltaire and Rousseau. That wasn't happening in America. In America, they were listening to the preaching of George Whitefield. America profited from the Great Awakening. Samuel Adams was a product of the Great Awakening. In fact, his sister would go to George Whitefield's sermons, take notes, and come back and read George Whitefield's sermons to Samuel Adams. Samuel Adams, his whole worldview was formed in George Whitefield's preaching. And, of course, Patrick Henry was a product of Samuel Davies and the Great Awakening in the Southern state. Whereas Robespierre and Rousseau were products of God-hating apostasy, at the same time, Patrick Henry, George Washington, Samuel Adams, they were a product of the great revivals that were going on in the 1760s and 1770s. Now, true, eventually deism won out in the 1790s, and then you get to the James Madisons and the James Monroes and others who utterly abandoned Christianity. Sadly, that happened later on. But the roots of the nation in the 1770s was formed in godly Christian men like Samuel Adams and Patrick Henry, who, by the way, were the two by far most influential men to establish the United States of America and bring about our independence. There wasn't anybody as important as they were. Read the story in American Faith, our 27 essays. Well, you know, ideas have consequences. The Christian ideas that came out of the Great Awakening resulted in America. The French ideas of Robespierre and Rousseau, that's where we began to see the corruption that destroyed Europe and eventually destroyed America as well. I wrote the book Apostate, The Men Who Destroyed the Christian West, about Rousseau and others who have had terrible effects upon the entire world over the last 150 years. Ideas have consequences. It's an interesting story here that I take from a book called 10 Books That Screwed Up the World and 5 That Didn't Help. And there's a Scottish essayist named Thomas Carlyle who was scolded at a dinner party for talking about books. And this is what the guy said. Ideas, Mr. Carlyle. Ideas, nothing but ideas. To which Carlyle replied, there once was a man called Rousseau who wrote a book containing ideas. The second edition was bound in the skin of those who laughed at the first edition. Ideas have consequences. And the ideas of Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Karl Marx and others have brought about untold suffering upon the entire world in the last 150 years, my friends. This know also, 2 Timothy 3, in the last days perilous times shall come, for men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy. These are the revolutionaries. These are Jean-Jacques Rousseau. These are the Robespierres of the world, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of that which is good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures, more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. Friends, if that doesn't point out the apostates of the last 2 to 3 centuries that came out of the Enlightenment and influenced the modern world, I don't know what would describe it. There it is in 2 Timothy 3, perilous times upon us because of these who had a form of godliness but denied the power thereof. As a nation, we are, I think, on the cusp of revival or French revolutions. Either it will be a great awakening and a great awakening that will produce good results, or it will be a French revolution that will produce terrible results. It will be revival or revolution. Blood on the streets, tyrants, dictators, will that be our future? Or will it be another awakening and a revival that will bring about something like a restoration of a Christian republic? What will it be? Well, give your children history. Teach them the principles of God's Word as they apply to history. And that's what we do with books like American Faith, America and God's Providence, The Story of Freedom, and of course my new book, Epoch, The Rise and Fall of the West. Get these books at our website, generations.org, and be sure you train your children in good history. Root and ground them in the principles of God's Word and give them a good view of history, the good, the bad, and the ugly, from a biblical worldview perspective. All of that available at generations.org. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.